This week's cover of the New Yorker magazine has Senator Obama in a turban giving dap to an AK-47 toting Michelle Obama, and that cartoon has gotten people hot. A rural town in central Ohio kept running water from black residents for almost 50 years, and Walmart pulls a racially charged Mexican comic book from the shelves. These are just some of the headlines we'll explore in today's Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us, Anthony Bradley, who blogs for the Acton Institute and is a professor at the Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for detroitnews.com. Hi, folks. How you doing?
Hi
there.
So let's go to this New Yorker cartoon. It's famous for its illustrated covers. The July 21st issue features a cartoon of Senator Obama wearing a turban, Michelle sporting an afro, Osama bin Laden smiles from a portrait in the Oval Office, and an American flag smolders in the fireplace. To understand what we're talking about, you can see it on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. And the illustration is by an artist called Barry Blitt. It's called The Politics of Fear. Tempest, the New Yorker is calling this satire, but is this more like throwing gasoline on a fire?
Probably. I can sort of see where they would say, well, but we're trying to make a point, but just basically from the article they're talking about, you know, these stereotypes that we have, these impressions, these things that we keep hearing in email campaigns, secret email campaigns against Obama. Having something like this on the cover is going to be provocative, which I guess they assumed, but it's also going to, at quick glance, give the people who already think that, you know, Obama is a Muslim terrorist and, you know, the terrorist fist jab and all these stupid things, you know, at first glance, people are just going to look at this and go, oh, well, the New Yorker agrees with me because look what they put on the cover.
Anthony, the Obama campaign has called this cover, quote, tasteless and offensive. The McCain camp also agrees. The McCain camp agreeing, is that a pro forma in the sense that this has to be decried by the white candidate in a race with a black man? It's interesting politics.
Well, of course, McCain is going to say that it's egregious that something like this happened. One has to wonder, however, when I first saw the cover, I wonder if the illustrator had been forwarded some cash by the McCain camp, because this is exactly the type of image that the McCain camp, for the last number of weeks and months, has wanted America to see in terms of assessing Obama.
That's a pretty strong allegation.
Well, it is a strong allegation, but I understand the nastiness of American politics, and I wouldn't be surprised necessarily if the illustrator in his own naivete may have made a big mistake. But I'm also not certain that some in the McCain camp aren't sort of secretly cheering that this cover is published.
Eric, we have heard time and time again about the statistics about a fairly significant percentage of Americans, and it goes up and down, but we're talking double digits, who actually think Senator Obama is Muslim. And the dynamics of whether or not, by kind of defending against that, Senator Obama himself seems anti-Muslim. What's the road that the Obama campaign has to take with this?
Well, the one road they have to take is the same road he always take, is to not comment on such stupid crap like this, because it's interesting that they call this the politics of fear, but what they are actually doing is perpetuating the ignorance that so many people have with regard to him. So he's taking a high road up to now. He needs to continue to take the high road, because sometimes when you respond to it, you come across, and then they will be easily able to portray him as the angry black male. So just continue to take the high road. That's one of the things that has really gotten a lot of people to endorse and or support Senator Obama, because he takes a higher road. Look what happened all during the primaries. He didn't respond to a lot of that crap that was going on with the Clintons in their camp. He took the higher road. He has to do it now.
Eric, I'm going to transition us. I'm going to stay with you, transition us to another topic. Now, we take water for granted, most of us. We like turning on the tap, brushing the teeth, taking the shower. But a mostly black neighborhood in rural Ohio didn't have running water for almost 50 years. Just last week, a federal court ruled that the town of Zanesville discriminated against the residents and awarded 67 plaintiffs a sum of $11 million. Now, from 1956 to 2003, the residents didn't have public water lines. They had to dig wells, collect rainwater. they paid to have these things done. That's how they drank, cooked, and bathed since the 50s. And, you know, what do you make of this story? Is it justice served?
Well, it's definitely not justice served for someone to receive as little as $15,000. But one of the most amazing things about the whole article, there was a 47-year-old woman that stated that as a child she thought this was normal. And it was actually 47 years that this town had no running water. So throughout her whole life, she thought this was normal. But she did not realize it until she was an adult that it was not. And that speaks to the whole issue of what this is about. I mean, it's sad that, you know, you try and look back and say, wow, things such as racism still exist. And we all know it still exists. But to this extent, and it still goes on, it just, you know, one of them shake your head moments. It's unfortunate. And, you know, there's not enough money in the world that can assist these people to have had gone through something like this for 47 years or more. This is Cynthia Hale Harrison. Her whole life, this is what she had to live through.
Anthony, oil, obviously extremely expensive. Some people think water is going to be the next big commodity. You saw a drought in Georgia. You've seen some rationing of water at different times in the U.S. Do you think this is a completely different perspective? But do you think, in a way, more people will begin to look at an option of trying to have their own water supply? This does not mean that the people in Ohio got a fair deal, but in a weird way, does it just sort of bring up the issue of what it means to have access to water?
It does, because it reminds us that there is passive structural discrimination in our nation's history at the hands of government. And maybe, perhaps, it might be more useful for some communities to bypass government altogether and find private mechanisms and private means to meet their needs. Those resources are there, but this dependence on government isn't always helpful. And we see this in the case for this poor town in Ohio.
We got to just touch on another topic. And Tempest, to keep it real short, there's a character called Memin Penguin, very popular in some parts of Mexico, dark-skinned boy, heavy lips, bulging eyes. The Mexican Postal Service issued a series of stamps. They sold out. This was back in 2005. Now he is listed in his books, as children's books, as making a run for president. Some people compare him to Little Black Sambo. Walmart carried the comic books and then had to yank them. Was that a good move?
Well, I guess it was a good move, just in terms of, because the community complained, and because these images are seen as stereotypically, you know, racist images, it is good that Walmart responded. I think that they probably didn't respond in text as well as they could have in the statement that they issued. But on the subject of the comic book in general, I feel that it's a problem that this was pulled because of this image without any sort of context for the image. Now, obviously, there's no context that can make a racist image any better, but from what I know of this comic, it seems to have to take on the issues of race and class in such a way that the depiction of the character itself is a statement. And I think that's important. But you can't always get that across to people on, you know, a shelf in a store. They walk past the display, they see a book with a racist image that very naturally makes them upset.
Quickly, we're going to go to a break in a second, but Little Black Sambo itself has made a resurgence in America. Do you think this is part of people getting a little too comfortable with some aspects of stereotyping?
Oh, definitely. Very much. We had talked a few months ago about the people showing up to Halloween parties in blackface, and that right there is just not acceptable. Basically, it is when the images are used in a way that does not have anything to do, does not acknowledge the history of them. At the very least, this image does acknowledge the history of the Sambo stereotype look.
All right, we're going to have to go take a break. Stay with us. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our bloggers roundtable. Got Anthony Bradley, who blogs for the Acton Institute and is a professor at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com. And Eric Brown, who blogs for detroitnews.com. I'm going to just jump into our last topic. It's Mamin Penguin, a dark-skinned boy with heavy lips and bulging eyes, a cartoon character. Now, children's books with this character are being sold in the United States, or they were, at Walmart until protesters got the comic book removed. That alone, to me, is interesting, Eric. It says a lot about the changing demographics of America and how things that are cultural touchstones, and this is beloved by many people, from what I understand, in Mexico, and now it's crossed over. You've got a large Mexican-American population that stretches from coast to coast, north to south. Can we expect more of these multicultural static moments in the future?
Yes, they will always be around, because what's going to happen is you're going to have the cultures that are new to America, or not just new, but becoming more prevalent in America, to press upon us to have to accept what their culture is. And this is exactly what happened with this character here. It's popular down in Mexico. You have a large percentage of Mexicans here in America. So Walmart thought they were doing a good thing by marketing something that their consumer base can relate to, forgetting about the fact that it's offensive to a lot of people. So, say, for instance, we get a great influx of people from Turkey coming to America, and there may be something over there that is discriminatory to us, but not to them. It might be a folk hero to them. So they're going to push that upon us and have us to accept it. But at the same time, the people that protested about this, they did the right thing, and in essence, now Walmart has decided to remove it from their shelves. But they should have been sensitive enough to know that it was wrong to begin with. You know, the companies ought to be aware of what's stereotypical and wrong as well.
At the same time, if it's a brisk seller, it seems appealing.
True, but what's the majority of? I mean, I see your point, but in the same token, if you're going to have people that are going to say that this can't be in, I would rather get it off my shelf than have protesters out in front of my store, because those protesters will prevent people from coming into your store. So you have to weigh the pros and cons of the situation.
Anthony, I'm going to move on to our final topic. The three surviving children of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King are duking it out in court. Bernice King and Martin Luther King III, who we spoke with recently but not about this, are suing Dexter King. They're all siblings, and they say Dexter took substantial funds from the family estate for personal use. Dexter splits his time between Atlanta and Malibu, California. He has allegedly refused to tell his siblings what he's up to with the money. He is the president of King & Incorporated. Bernice and Martin III are shareholders. And in 2006, the King Estate, which controls the use of the image of Reverend King, sold a private collection of his papers estimated at about $30 million. This story was reported on TMZ, the celebrity gossip site, under the headline MLK's Bad Dream. Anthony, what do you think this says about the legacy of one of the greatest families in the civil rights movement?
It's actually sadly tragic that this is being displayed in public. It's also not anything we should be surprised by. I mean, there are lots of wealthy families that have huge estates that enter into sibling rivalries and all sorts of really sad conflicts once the parents are dead. I think what's most troubling about the situation is that Bernice and Martin III have been kept out of the transactions that Dexter has been engaging in, even though they've asked him for those records and he has refused to give them the information. And they're shareholders in the corporation, and they deserve to know exactly what he's up to. And so what's most tragic is that there is a lack of communication between these siblings, and it sadly reminds us of the legacy when you mix money and power and family. It can get quite ugly.
Tempest, shortly after the death of Coretta Scott King in January of 2006, Dexter King started a little bit of talk about selling the King Center to the federal government, and Bernice and Martin Luther III refused. Do you think they might have actually been better off if they collectively gave away control of this entity?
I'm not so sure of that, only because just looking at the history of civil rights and the civil rights struggle, you know, down through time as relates to the Kings and also to just in general, it seems as though giving away that control would have resulted in some of the watering down that we often see in, you know, talk about, you know, where the civil rights struggle has gone and how much it has achieved its goals and things like this. So I am more in favor of keeping things close and keeping things in control, because once you give it away, you know, anything can happen. Any falsehood can slip in. Anything can be elided over.
Eric, there's been some fairly dramatic fireworks in another civil rights family. Reverend Jesse Jackson, of course, made certain remarks about Barack Obama that got him in hot water. Now an activist in Los Angeles is calling him out as an absentee father to the 10-year-old daughter who is a result of an affair that he had. And it's quite snippy. You can see it on our website. First of all, is it fair game to talk about that? And secondly, does it tarnish the collective reputation of the civil rights movement to see that some of the families in their second generation are having so much trouble?
I don't think it tarnishes the civil rights movement, but one thing that the activists in L.A. has done is shown how careful you have to be when you make derogatory comments about someone. If you have skeletons in your own closet, they will always come back to haunt you, and this is a perfect example. What he said about Senator Obama was ridiculous, but you can't make stupid things or say stupid things and not expect someone to come out and attack you for you having the nerve to say something so stupid. I mean, he should have known better. I mean, a lot of people think that he knew the mic was on and he orchestrated the situation last week. That's neither here nor there. Bottom line, he should have never opened up his mouth to say something so terrible about another black man that will probably be the first president that is an American African descent in this country and probably the last. So this moment is probably being more tarnished more so than the legacy of the civil rights movement.
All right, before we wrap this up, why do you say, many people are saying he could be the first black president, but why are you saying that he would probably be the last?
Why do I say he would probably be the last?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that his candidacy has been such a movement as such that it would take another person of color to do something even more phenomenal that he has done thus far. And you still have a lot of people that are hating on him, people that look like him, people of other races, that some people are like, wow, I never thought he would get to this point. And if he does get to this point, we just live in a country that people are so vindictive, they will do whatever they can to see that doesn't happen again.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ray.
We were talking to our bloggers, Anthony Bradley, who blogs for the Acton Institute and is a professor at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. He joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for DetroitNews.com. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our bloggers roundtable. Got Anthony Bradley, who blogs for the Acton Institute and is a professor at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for DetroitNews.com. I'm going to just jump into our last topic. It's Maimin Penguin, a dark-skinned boy with heavy lips and bulging eyes, a cartoon character. Now, children's books with this character are being sold in the United States, or they were, at Walmart until protesters got the comic book removed. That alone to me is interesting, Eric. It says a lot about the changing demographics of America and how things that are cultural touchstones, and this is beloved by many people from what I understand in Mexico, and now it's crossed over. You've got a large Mexican-American population that stretches from coast to coast, north to south. Can we expect more of these multicultural static moments in the future?
Yes, they will always be around, because what's going to happen is you're going to have the cultures that are new to America, or not just new, but becoming more prevalent in America, to press upon us to have to accept what their culture is. And this is exactly what happened with this character here. It's popular down in Mexico. You have a large percentage of Mexicans here in America. So Walmart thought they were doing a good thing by marketing something that their consumer base can relate to, forgetting about the fact that it's offensive to a lot of people. So say, for instance, we get a great influx of people from Turkey coming to America, and there may be something over there that is discriminatory to us, but not to them. Might be a folk hero to them. So they're going to push that upon us and have us to accept it. But at the same time, the people that protested about this, they did the right thing. And in essence, now Walmart has decided to remove it from their shelves. But they should have been sensitive enough to know that it was wrong to begin with. You know, the companies ought to be aware of what's stereotypical and wrong as well.
At the same time, if it's a brisk seller, it seems appealing.
True, but what's the majority of, I mean, I see your point, but in the same token, if you're going to have people that are going to say that this can't be in, I would rather get it off my shelf than have protesters out in front of my store, because those protesters will prevent people from coming into your store. So you have to weigh the pros and cons of the situation.
Anthony, I'm going to move on to our final topic. The three surviving children of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King are duking it out in court. Bernice King and Martin Luther King III, who we spoke with recently but not about this, are suing Dexter King. They're all siblings, and they say Dexter took substantial funds from the family estate for personal use. Dexter splits his time between Atlanta and Malibu, California. He has allegedly refused to tell his siblings what he's up to with the money. He is the president of King & Incorporated. Bernice and Martin III are shareholders. And in 2006, the King Estate, which controls the use of the image of Reverend King, sold a private collection of his papers estimated at about $30 million. This story was reported on TMZ, the celebrity gossip site, under the headline MLK's Bad Dream. Anthony, what do you think this says about the legacy of one of the greatest families in the civil rights movement?
It's actually sadly tragic that this is being displayed in public. It's also not anything we should be surprised by. I mean, there are lots of wealthy families that have huge estates that enter into sibling rivalries and all sorts of really sad conflicts once the parents are dead. I think what's most troubling about the situation is that Bernice and Martin III have been kept out of the transactions that Dexter has been engaging in, even though they've asked him for those records and he has refused to give them the information. And they're shareholders in the corporation, and they deserve to know exactly what he's up to. And so what's most tragic is that there is a lack of communication between these siblings, and it sadly reminds us of the legacy when you mix money and power and family. It can get quite ugly.
Tempest, shortly after the death of Coretta Scott King in January of 2006, Dexter King started a little bit of talk about selling the King Center to the federal government, and Bernice and Martin Luther III refused. Do you think they might have actually been better off if they collectively gave away control of this entity?
I'm not so sure of that, only because just looking at the history of civil rights and the civil rights struggle, you know, down through time as relates to the Kings and also to just in general, it seems as though giving away that control would have resulted in some of the watering down that we often see in, you know, talk about, you know, where the civil rights struggle has gone and how much it has achieved its goals and things like this. So I am more in favor of keeping things close and keeping things in control, because once you give it away, you know, anything can happen. Any falsehood can slip in. Anything can be elided over.
Eric, there's been some fairly dramatic fireworks in another civil rights family. Reverend Jesse Jackson, of course, made certain remarks about Barack Obama that got him in hot water. Now an activist in Los Angeles is calling him out as an absentee father to the 10-year-old daughter who is a result of an affair that he had. And it's quite snippy. You can see it on our website. First of all, is it fair game to talk about that? And secondly, does it tarnish the collective reputation of the civil rights movement to see that some of the families in their second generation are having so much trouble?
I don't think it tarnishes the civil rights movement, but one thing that the activists in L.A. has done is shown how careful you have to be when you make derogatory comments about someone. If you have skeletons in your own closet, they will always come back to haunt you, and this is a perfect example. What he said about Senator Obama was ridiculous, but you can't make stupid things or say stupid things and not expect someone to come out and attack you for you having the nerve to say something so stupid. I mean, he should have known better. I mean, a lot of people think that he knew the mic was on and he orchestrated the situation last week. That's neither here nor there. Bottom line, he should have never opened up his mouth to say something so terrible about another black man that will probably be the first president that is an American African descent in this country and probably the last. So this moment is probably being more tarnished more so than the legacy of the civil rights movement.
All right, before we wrap this up, why do you say, many people are saying he could be the first black president, but why are you saying that he would probably be the last?
Why do I say he would probably be the last?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that his candidacy has been such a movement as such that it would take another person of color to do something even more phenomenal that he has done thus far. And you still have a lot of people that are hating on him, people that look like him, people of other races, that some people are like, wow, I never thought he would get to this point. And if he does get to this point, we just live in a country that people are so vindictive, they will do whatever they can to see that doesn't happen again.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
We were talking to our bloggers, Anthony Bradley, who blogs for the Acton Institute and is a professor at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. He joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Kay Tempest Bradford, who blogs at theangryblackwoman.com, and Eric Brown, who blogs for DetroitNews.com. More than 90,000 students each year get a brand new MBA or Master's of Business Administration degree. That means there's a lot of new talent ready to show just how good they are. But sometimes being good is not enough. That's what Keith Weish says. His new book is Good Is Not Enough. It offers some concrete solutions for professionals of color who want more from their careers. Keith is the president of the U.S. operations of Pitney Bowes Management Services. That's a male outsourcing business headquartered in Stamford, Connecticut. Keith, welcome.
Welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
So your book is called Good Is Not Enough. That is something that could make some people a little scared or panicked. Why should people not be?
Well, you know, most of us, if we go back to our childhood, would say that at some point as a minority, a mother, a father, some figure in our life share it with us that really in life it's not fair and it's not something that we like. But good is not enough if you are a minority professional and you grow up understanding that there will be expectations placed upon you that you have to overcome. The reality of it is if you go into this thinking you could just be good, you'll end up with a mediocre career. And so good is not enough is really just a sounding call to minority professionals saying, hey, you know, we can be players at this level, but we can't just play good. We have to excel.
Let's break down a few of the things that you say matter. One is networking. Why so important?
Networking is so important because in this day and age, a lot of the jobs, a lot of the opportunities that will come your way will not be through Monster, will not be through the want ads. It will be through networking. And so from a career perspective, opportunities will come your way from networking. But more importantly, networking is a great opportunity to learn from others who have been down the road that you are trying to go. For example, if I'm at a company right now, I'm at Pitney Bowes and I love being there, but if I were to look at an opportunity at IBM, if I have a network that includes someone at IBM, I could actually call and get a better idea of what it is I'm stepping into because corporate culture is just critical.
But how do you find someone who is a peer or a mentor at another company?
I am a big fan of professional organizations. I'm a board member of the National Black MBA Association, and my associations with groups like that, groups like the Urban League, groups like Neshemba, give you an opportunity to meet and network with professionals and peers all across the country.
Okay, performance. What really makes your performance sing?
Well, you know, performance is really one of making sure you understand and document what's expected of you in your given role. One of the mistakes I see many professionals make, minority or otherwise, is they don't document and understand really what's expected of them. And so they go throughout the whole year performing at what they may think is the optimum level, only to get to the end of the year and find out that they've missed the mark. They're not doing one-on-ones or meetings quarterly or monthly with their manager. And so it's really important that if you're going to, you know, track your performance, that you understand what's expected, but more importantly, that you follow up to make sure that you're on course.
Now, you have these performance evaluations in some cases, and is that 100% of your success? How much are we talking about?
Yeah, I'm a big believer that success in corporate America, that performance really accounts for 50% of that. And what I mean by that is if you go back to childhood, most of what we were taught as children was you are rewarded based on how well you perform. So in kindergarten, you learn your alphabet, you get a gold star. Later on in high school, you become on the merit roll, honor roll. The problem with that is that when you get to the real world, performance is 50%. The other 50% is made up of what I would call 25% exposure, being exposed to the right people and the right information, and then perception, making sure that your brand is out there and it speaks for you because perception is pivotal.
Now, when you have a moment, or if you have a moment, where you believe that someone has been promoted over you based on race or gender or some other factor that is actionable by law, what do you do?
One, you better be very fact-based before you make that allegation, because that's not a card you want to play lightly. I'd say even before you play that, you want to make sure that you understand as best you can why you did not receive the position, not so much why the other person did. And if after all else fails, you truly feel that you have somehow been overlooked and that been wronged, I would really ask you to work with your HR professionals in your organization, because if you work for an organization that has a corporate culture that respects diversity and fairness, they will address that.
Now, you also mentioned some rules for avoiding sexual harassment allegations. What do you see there?
Well, you know, in this day and age, you have to be so very careful in how you handle dealings with the opposite sex. I would tell anyone that, you know, as a rule of thumb, you know, I don't have closed door meetings with members of the opposite sex. I don't believe in, for example, at awards presentations, hugging members of the opposite sex when they come across the stage. You just really want to avoid the very appearance, something that could be very subtle and meaningless to you. Could actually prove to be something that's damaging to that person because of how they perceive it. So it's best just to avoid it. I know it's unfortunate, but even to this day, I don't tell my assistant she looks nice. I just try and avoid the very appearance of it just to really just make it a non-issue.
Are men and women treated differently, particularly professionals of color?
Well,
from each other, I mean.
From each other.
Yeah, male and female professionals of color, do they face different challenges?
I think they do face different challenges, and particularly when I look at women, they can tend to be branded things like too emotional or not competitive or not dedicated, because there's some unique skill sets that women bring that I think really add value. So, for example, I find that women are more intuitive, which means for me they can be better forecasters of future trends. They're more nurturing, which means they're better attuned to the needs of their people and really better at developing people. And they actually are better communicators to me. I know that's a surprise to a lot of listeners, but I find that they're more responsive to giving and receiving feedback.
Just quickly, what about men?
Men. Men, we tend to focus more on outcomes than process. And so we kind of, you know, focus almost exclusively on the outcomes. We tend to like win-lose scenarios as opposed to negotiating for win-win. And then men, we tend to be command and control leaders, whereas women can be more inclusive, interactive. And so we really have to work on those traits.
Has anyone ever given you static for trying to do the Mars-Venus thing about how you see men and women?
Well, because it's really my opinion. They typically let me have that opinion. But again, it's really a broad statement, so I'm not saying all men are all women. But just as a rule, there's just some observations that I've had over the years.
Well, we thank you for those observations.
You're welcome.
Keith Weiss's new book is called Good Is Not Enough and Other Unwritten Rules for Minority Professionals. He joined us from our studios in New York City.